This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents Heretic Spellblade 3, Book 3 of Heretic Spellblade, written by K.D. Robertson, performed by Stephanie Savannah. Chapter 1. Nathan sat alone in his office as dawn arrived. The sun crept over the fortress of Garrick Pass and shined through the narrow window in his office. Noticing that sunlight had lit up the room, Nathan raised his hand and flicked off the far light switch with a flash of magic. A moment later, the lights flickered off, as the magic that powered them vanished. If Nathan felt generous, he'd describe his office as cozy. It contained his desk, a large table in the center that seated four, and rows of shelves along the walls. Neat stacks of paperwork lined his desk, and he slowly worked through them. A clock ticked in the corner, and a map of the region hung on the wall.
"Nathan, you missed breakfast," a familiar voice whined.
A beautiful cat beastkin appeared in the open doorway, carrying two plates of food. She had luscious black hair, tufted black cat ears, and a bushy tail that always seemed to need grooming, especially this morning, as her hair and tail looked to be a complete mess. Her black and silver uniform accentuated her curves, and especially her hefty bust. A sapphire gem glittered in her collarbone.
"I have a meeting with Naughty May and Seraph this morning, Fay," Nathan said, turning his attention back to his paperwork. He paused. "Did you at least bring a coffee?"
Fay rolled her eyes, then turned to her side.
"Bring Nathan a coffee."
A pair of guards stood outside Nathan's office at all hours, and they jumped to attention in response to Fay's order.
"Yes, Captain!"
one of the guards shouted. The hallway filled with the clatter of her boots. Then Fay stepped inside the office and deposited the food. Nathan noticed that her plate contained a lot more. Enough to feed 10 men, in fact. Fay ate enough to bankrupt the average baron in a month, and nobody knew where it all went. Her plate was loaded down with meat, fried eggs, and hashed potatoes. Nathan's was far tamer. Nathan blinked as he noticed a purple metal comb sitting on his desk, next to his cutlery.
"Is this some sort of imported knife?" he joked, preparing to cut into his breakfast sausages with the comb.
Fay shot to her feet with a strangled scream.
"Don't you dare!"
"Relax, Fay," he laughed. "Finish your food, then I'll comb out your hair and tail if you're well-behaved. But only if I get my coffee."
The cat girl redirected her glare to the doorway, and she wolfed down her food with a glower. Only when the guard returned with a steaming mug of coffee did she cheer up. After she finished her food, Fay planted herself next to him. Her humming filled the office as she waited patiently for Nathan to begin combing her hair. Black cat ears twitched cutely in his peripheral vision, and he gave in without much struggle. As he spent the next 30 minutes taking care of his cat girl, Nathan let his thoughts wander. Over 2 months had passed since he had invaded the Federation. 1 month since the Amica Federation had officially become part of the Onfang Empire. Nathan was a bastion of the Empire, and that made him a military commander with immense power. But reality was more complicated. A little over 12 months ago, Nathan had lived in a different kingdom, defending a fortress at the edge of the known world. He had lost everything, and then been offered the chance to go back in time to change it all. Or so he had thought. In truth, he now stood in a different world than the one he had been born in. He had been born Nathan Martell, but had taken over the life and body of Nathan Straub. But most things remained the same, and he had used his knowledge of the future to prevent the end of the world. That was why he could enjoy this quiet morning with Fay. Over the last year, he had stopped the demonic invasion that happened in his original world, captured the instigator, and then conquered the Federation. What's the meeting about? Fay asked, her back still turned to him as he focused on her hair.
We'll be going over the work to be done while I'll be away, Nathan answered.
Away? Fay spun around, then yelped as she yanked the comb out of his hand in the process. Nathan straightened her head, then resumed taming her hair.
I know it's early, but you do remember that we're leaving to visit Vera and Anna tomorrow, right?
We?
Fay remained silent for several seconds.
Oh, whoops, I forgot.
Resisting the urge to bonk his catgirl on the head, Nathan said, Remind me again who is in charge of my knights. Who is the beastkin that all of my soldiers are beginning to look up to and call captain and think so highly of? Is it you who forgot to give them orders while you'll be away for a week or more?
Yes? Fay squeaked out. I probably told Kara about it, so it should be fine.
Kara was Faye's lieutenant who helped her do her job, or realistically, did her job for her. If Nathan felt mean, he'd say that Faye's job was to look pretty while stabbing things. But she was very good at that, so he forgave her.
Don't rely on your lieutenant to do everything, he said. I gave you, Sunstorm, and Sen promotions before we attacked the Federation, because I felt you deserved it. You still need to prove to me that you do.
Fay grumbled, but remained silent. Nathan was a bastion, one of the most powerful and influential individuals in the world. He controlled reality-bending binding stones that dotted the world, and in turn had some of the strongest warriors in the Empire under his command. Fay was one of those warriors, known as a champion. The sapphire that gleamed in her collarbone was proof that she was one. He commanded multiple other champions. Sunstorm was another, an assassin born in the Kurai Peninsula, but who grew up in the Federation after her homeland was overrun by demons. Another one was Sen, who was a powerful spellblade possessed by the spirit Ifrit. Both Sen and Sunstorm knew about Nathan's past, but had incomplete memories of it.
Oh, I didn't know Fay was invited to this meeting, a new voice said from the doorway.
Nathan and Fay looked over to see a gorgeous foxwoman slink in, wearing a figure-hugging blue dress. A pair of sapphires shimmered in her collar, and six massive, fluffy silver tails flowed behind her body. This was Narime, another of Nathan's champions. She strode over to Nathan and planted a heated kiss on his lips. Fay whined in protest, but remained still due to the comb in her hair.
No fair, Fay said. Oh, hush! You claim him like this every morning, Narime said as she pulled away. Why don't we hold our meeting outside, Nathan? It's a glorious spring day, and it's nearly summer. Perfect weather to sit together outside and talk while basking in each other's company, our hands linked, and my tails wrapped around your body.
Fay pouted.
But my tail, goddess, I let him finish grooming you, the fox said. Then we'll go outside.
Nathan didn't interrupt the play-fighting between his champions. He shared his bed with both of these women, if not at the same time. While Fay grew more adventurous toward his other lovers, Narime remained nervous. But Nathan loved them all equally, although he made sure that Fay's jealousy never got out of control. He found her cattiness adorable, but only in small doses. Nathan finished combing out Fay's tail, and she made her happiness plain to everybody with the scent she gave off. A moment later, Narime hoisted him from his chair and yanked him away from his desk.
Oh, and Fay, Narime called out to the dazed cat girl, make sure that everything is ready before you leave. I'll be very disappointed if I have to chase things up, or if Nathan needs to cover for you.
Fay squeaked, but her response was lost as Nathan and Narime left. They quickly found themselves in the rear courtyard,
Given the time and weather, the dining area out here was packed with soldiers and knights. Servants rushed about with food and drink, while the soldiers bantered and laughed. Nathan noted that a lot of his beastkin knights wore a patch on their uniform. It was an altered crest of Nathan's family, the family that had disowned him years ago. The normal crest consisted of a stylized helmet on top of a white shield and black background. The altered crest added a pair of black cat ears and a series of different animal tails around the helmet. He clicked his tongue as he passed the soldiers, but said nothing openly. Narime noticed. The eyes of his female knights followed him as he passed them. He pretended not to notice the lust in their eyes, or the way their tails wagged when he passed them. A few said hello or called out to him as he passed, and he made sure to respond. He had grown used to their attention over the last several months. Narime led him to one of the quieter spots in the rear courtyard of the castle, away from the feasting soldiers.
"How are you settling in?" Nathan asked her.
Narime had only joined Nathan as a champion when he invaded the Federation, but he had known her for years in his world, which meant he trusted her implicitly. She had centuries of experience under her belt, and he trusted her strategic advice above almost anyone else's. Naturally, he had given her overall command of military deployments in his absence. If something happened, he knew she could handle it. Officially, that meant Narime was in charge of Fae. In practice, things were more complicated.
"It's difficult," Narime admitted. "I can settle into the fortress, learn the region, the customs, and everything else within days. That was the easy part. What's harder is everything else. I've spent years in the Federation. Even though it's now part of the Empire, that doesn't mean it magically changes overnight. Even if the Empire abolishes beastkin slavery, people don't change just because their cities fly new flags."
"I guess that's the problem with a peaceful annexation," Nathan said. "Other than Tanius, all the regents became dukes in the Empire."
High Lord Tanius had been the instigator behind the war between the Empire and the Federation. When Nathan toppled him, the Federation had surrendered. In exchange, the Empire had taken no punitive action. Tanius's territory had been split up. Most of it had been given to the noblewoman Anna von Clare, who was one of Nathan's closest allies and his lover. Nathan had become a national hero overnight.
"And Anna became a duchess," Narime pointed out. "I'm still surprised at that. She convinced herself to only be an imperial countess and let you move past her. Then you made her a very happy little noble, and she convinced the emperor to make her a duchess instead. For you."
"She was always supposed to become duchess," Nathan said. "Once she knew I supported her, she was offered the position they wanted her to take to begin with."
"Planning to become Nathan von Clare anytime soon?" the fox teased.
"I'm pretty sure she's measured my ring finger while I've slept," Nathan joked. "But I don't think we'll be marrying anytime soon, or having children."
"Good."
Narime leaned over and shrouded him in her tails.
"It's so much easier to share you while you don't have a wife."
Nathan changed the topic before Narime did anything she shouldn't while in public.
"You said that people don't change, but that's why I need you to help. The world changes day by day. Once people get used to peace and the new way things are done, they'll expect the future to remain that way."
"True," Narime said.
She leaned away.
"People can change. I'm changing because of you."
A cough interrupted them. Narime narrowed her eyes.
"How did you find us so fast?" the fox said, turning to the new arrival.
"Because I'm not stupid," Seraph said,
amusement laced through her voice.
"I asked whether anyone had seen Nathan when I arrived here through the gateway. Do you really think people won't notice you flirting with him out in the open?
Nathan looked over at the castle. Dozens of beastkin knights stared at him, their ears and tails pricked up. Faye had joined them, sitting next to her dog beastkin lieutenant. Given the excellent hearing of most beastkin, he wondered how private his discussion truly was. A moment later, he cast a magic ward to stop eavesdropping. The beastkin ears lowered. Nathan sighed. Of course. Well, you're both here. Let's start the meeting, he said, gesturing Seraph to sit on the opposite side of the table they sat at. Seraph held an exotic beauty in comparison to most of his champions. Like Sunstorm, she hailed from Kurai, but she was older. A pair of jade gems sat in her chest. Her red and black Changsam hugged her figure tightly, and her eyes had a dangerous gleam to them. But she was loyal. Most importantly, Nathan relied on her to run a lot of his administrative matters. She had originally been his enemy, but now served him without question.
I've noticed that the crests have increased in number, Seraph said, referring to the patches that the beastkin wore on their shoulders. Thank you for raising a topic I wanted to avoid,
Narime replied, her tone acidic.
It's wise to tackle our problems head on.
Settle down, ladies, Nathan said, rubbing the bridge of his nose. The crest is treasonous. I don't like it. The problem is, discouraging it hasn't worked. Do we know why yet?
Anna's encouraging it, Seraph said simply. And the beastkin think it's a sign of loyalty to you. There are a lot of people upset about the end of beastkin slavery in the Federation, so many of your knights feel defensive.
Nathan held back a sigh. All of that added up, but he supposed he had only himself to blame. He had chosen to focus on recruiting beastkin knights, given the physical advantages they had over humans.
I don't think it's as big of a problem as you say, Narime said. They're showing loyalty to you. Given how tense things are in the Empire right now, I don't think that's a mistake.
I'm not a private noble like Anna, Nathan explained. I serve Emperor Gortal and nobody else. If my soldiers show fealty to me rather than their actual liege, it raises questions about my loyalty. History is full of examples of what happens when armies are more loyal to their general than to their nations.
Are you planning to overthrow the Emperor? Seraph asked.
No.
Just checking, Seraph said.
He rolled his eyes. But it will look that way, or it will be a convenient excuse for bad actors who want to paint me in a negative light.
The Nationalists will paint you in a bad light anyway. They're pushing for a civil war, and you worry them, Nathan. You've become a hero overnight, Narime insisted. But if you want to discourage the crests, I'll continue to push. Faye can help.
And that brought things back to his original topic. Both of you spend a lot of time away from Garrick Pass, unlike Faye and the others, Nathan said. I have teleportation gateways to connect all of my binding stones, except the one at Castle Tardis, where Anna is. We should use them more often.
My office is a lot nicer than yours, Seraph said with a smirk.
You're ignoring my point, he replied. Narime sighed.
Like I said, it's harder to settle in than it appears. Garrick Pass is Faye's turf. As champions, we move between the fortresses instantly, but the knights and soldiers don't. I help you run the military, but I'm better known up north in Castle Fosselberg because it's former Federation territory. I'll force my way in here with enough time, but as Faye gets better at commanding, there will be less reason to boss her around.
Nathan wanted to object, but he knew better. In his world, Faye grew up to a worldly and reliable woman. She had been Nathan's most reliable champion in many ways. Writing her off because she still needed time to grow into her position would be a mistake.
I'd still like to see you around here more, he said.
I'm still busy, Seraph said. I've already established Fort Tobram as an administrative hub. More people can visit it than Garrick Pass anyway.
She paused.
I'll make an effort to visit more often, but I don't need to see your paperwork to imagine how much there is. We're trying to rebuild after a war while preparing for another one.
He grimaced. She had succinctly covered his concerns. It was late spring, and the first harvest of the year was rapidly approaching. Nathan knew that everything was far more complicated this year. An invasion had happened. Countries had dissolved. Laws, taxes, and land ownership were shifting beneath the feet of the farmers. In the end, the people he protected just wanted to grow their food and go about their day. They didn't want to worry about bandits, silly tax changes, nobles they had never met, or changes to slavery laws, when most of them had never even seen a beastkin. Nathan had more people to protect than ever, and land that thrived. In his world, nobody worked a lot of the land he now protected. It had been overrun by demons. How many of these soldiers had died in his original world? Almost all of them, he knew. This peace had been won through the blood of an entire world that only Nathan knew about. Yet that peace remained as fragile as ever.
Leave the future to me, Nathan said. I'm about to visit Anna and talk to her about politics. There may be a civil war brewing, but we can't spend all our time worrying about it.
That's what this meeting is about, isn't it? Narime teased. How we replace you while you're gone.
And here I thought you had already replaced me everywhere except the bedroom. If I vanish, do you even need me to do anything, Seraph? He asked with a wink.
Don't joke about that, Seraph said. I'd need to find 10 men to handle the amount of work I send to you. You are going to hire more clerks to help me, right? Kuda's team is great, but we control nearly 10 times the territory now.
Yes, I will, he promised.
Good. Now, let's talk business, Seraph said,
and they got down to the details. The day after the meeting, Nathan left with Faye and a company of Beastkin Knights. His destination was a fortress to the east of Garrick Pass, on the border of Anna's duchy. It lay to the north of the duchy's capital of Tartus. Nathan was the only bastion in the duchy, and he had complete command of the Imperial army in the region, and also of Anna's army, given how close he was to her. That meant he was responsible for protecting everything inside its borders. But this visit was special. He was visiting a friend that he had promised to train to be a bastion, the sorceress Vera Nair. A small fort sat in a rocky, infertile part of the region among abandoned quarries and mines. The locals had several names for it, as the fort was ancient. But these days it was known as Cravum Rock, named after a famous bastion. The fort was tiny and weathered. A single layer of tall sandstone walls sat on overlooking bluffs. A much taller keep stood within those walls, and it was also built from sandstone. A handful of soldiers bearing Anna's emblem greeted Nathan as he rode in. Faye took charge of her knights. He took the opportunity to slip inside the keep while she ran through a few short drills and had them unpack their supplies. Despite the weathered exterior, the inside was fully furnished and clean. Nobody greeted him, however. In fact, there was nobody inside at all. The keep was a tall, narrow building. The central hall occupied most of the interior, and Nathan saw an empty meeting space at the far end. Vera was alone here, besides the few soldiers outside. Nathan doubted that she'd redecorated. Most likely this place hadn't seen much use. A double-door gate stood at the far end. Magical runes glittered on it, preventing access. Nathan was the only person who knew how to open the gate. He had engraved those runes into the door, after all. If somebody looked at the keep from the outside, they wouldn't see the other side of that gate, however.
it didn't lead anywhere in this plane of existence. Ignoring it, Nathan instead descended into the basement. The moment he reached the bottom level of the keep, he heard mumbling. As expected, Vera was down here. This level of the basement consisted of a single large room, a glowing orb set in the stone flooring, surrounded by decorative engravings and writing. The orb appeared to be a dull monochromic white, with two black bands running across its surface. It was known as a binding stone, a magical artifact that enabled its controller to bend the fabric of reality. Nathan controlled four binding stones that made him extremely powerful as far as bastions went. Normally, the farther a bastion got from his binding stones, the less powerful he became. But with multiple binding stones, he had an immense reserve of power to draw on. A gorgeous woman stood next to the orb. She wore a blue robe and gleaming white jacket that emphasized her hefty cleavage. Her usual assortment of golden jewelry was nowhere to be seen, however. Her flowing red hair fell to her waist. "Waste enough time down here?" Nathan said loudly as he exited the staircase. The woman, Vera, turned. She smiled at Nathan. "I wouldn't call it a waste. I'm a sorceress, and what better way to learn more about magical theory than to observe it in the real world?" "You'll think otherwise once I just tell you about this stuff, even if I'm taking it slow," Nathan said. "The more you learn about binding stones, messengers, and the way magic works, the more your faith is tested. That's why bastions take oaths to Omria not to share or abuse those secrets or the power of the stones." "And it's why heresy is so dangerous," Vera added with a frown. Both of them grimaced, but for different reasons. Vera had flirted with heresy when she had worked with the Federation last year. Although she had sided with Nathan and the Empire in the end, it still raised questions about her. By contrast, Nathan was up to his neck in heresy. The difference was that almost nobody knew. When his world had been destroyed, he had sided with a demonic messenger, one of the greatest enemies of a bastion, in order to have a second chance. He didn't regret his decision, but it made his words ring hollow. His faith in the Watcher Omria had been tested, and it had shattered. Nathan gestured for her to join him on a walk upstairs. They began to ascend, and he locked the doors behind them. "How slow is slow?" Vera asked. "As slow as I feel is necessary," he said. "Power changes people. A binding stone is power on a level that most people can't comprehend. Bastions can create precious metals from nothing. They command elite warriors capable of destroying armies. Women throw themselves at them. Men, in your case." "No, thank you," Vera said flatly. "I already told you that I'm not interested in that side of things. My entire life has been one of seclusion, and I liked it that way."
"That doesn't help your argument for becoming a bastion."
She remained silent as they walked through the empty main hall. They walked up the steps to the upper floors until they reached Vera's private quarters. Like everything else in the keep, it was small and cramped. Most of the room was taken up by magical knick-knacks, but there was a tidy bed and dressing table. "I'm willing to change to become a bastion. A lot is changing in my life. It's why I came here early and left my tower behind," Vera said. "You're giving me the chance for something that I nearly gave up on. But I'm not interested in a legion of subservient beastkin whose tails wag whenever I'm near them, and whose expressions scream, 'Breed me.'" "I feel you're making a statement," Nathan said. He leaned against the open window in the room. "I am, but that's not what I'm getting at. I saw what happened to Leopold when we fought the messenger. He's considered one of the greatest bastions of the Empire, and he nearly died. That was the price he was willing to pay for being a bastion." Vera closed her eyes. "Ah, Leopold Tyrum, Nathan's superior and the right hand of the Emperor.
He was a cunning old man who had staunchly supported Nathan.
That's what it means to be a bastion, Vera. As immensely powerful as you'll become, it's tied with the duty to fend off endless waves of demons, Nathan said. Right now, I've sealed away the demonic portal of this fortress using runes, but the demons will be gathering. Once you become a bastion, we'll need to go through that gate and destroy them.
He was referring to the double-door gate in the main hall of the keep. Every binding stone came with a dangerous penalty. A portal to hell, or some other strange world, was permanently connected to the location of each binding stone. Demons constantly invaded through them. Rarely, a powerful demonic general, known as a messenger, attacked. Messengers were like bastions amped up to the nth degree. A messenger had defeated Nathan in his original world, defeating countless champions effortlessly. A couple of months ago, he had defeated a messenger in this world with Vera's and Leopold's help. Leopold had nearly died in the battle. Vera sighed. I know. It's the part of being a bastion that I both welcome and dread. She changed the topic. Are you visiting Anna soon? He raised an eyebrow at the sudden topic change.
That's the plan. But first, I think we should spend a few days going over some basic bastion training.
Vera brightened up at the change of topic. The training allowed Nathan to focus on something simple. After a few days, he left Vera and the knights behind at Cravum Rock. He and Faye prepared to ride south, to Tartus. One of Vera's topics sprung to mind as he mounted his horse.
Change, huh? He said, staring at the cloudless horizon.
A lot had changed for Nathan, and he had changed a lot. The world he lived in now had nothing in common with the world he came from. Predicting the future was impossible, but he was still a bastion, and had years of experience and the support of many talented people. Faye smiled at him, and he smiled back. They rode to Tartus, where he would meet Anna in the capital of her new duchy. They needed to make preparations for the coming problems. Chapter 2 The city of Tartus hadn't changed much since joining the Empire. It had been the capital of its province in the Federation. Now it was the capital of its duchy in the Empire. Nathan and Faye navigated through the dense urban sprawl of the city. Marble, granite, and wooden buildings stood side by side in a manner that should appear ramshackle, but somehow looked normal. Local guards swapped out their Federation crests for Anna's emblem. Markets ran day and night in the city, and a throng of people filled the streets. Nathan kept his hands free to bat away pickpockets who got too close. Not that he needed to bother. Everybody recognized him. The crowds cleared a path as he rode. Nathan arrived at Tartus's palace. It was a squat marble building formed of columns, with a series of steps to gain access to the building itself. Guards patrolled around the base of the building. At the top of the steps was something that had changed drastically since the city had joined the Empire, however. Heavily armed and armored beastkin knights stood guard. They wore the same uniforms as Faye's knights, except that they also had Anna's emblem on their armor. As Nathan approached, they slammed their fists into their breastplates. A deafening boom echoed off the marble structure. Other knights heard the salute and repeated it. The noise continued for over a minute. Nathan walked past them and entered the palace. Long ago, this building had been the gathering hall for village chiefs and nobles. Over time, as Tartus grew in size, it became a palace. Its former occupant had been High Lord Taunius, who was now in the custody of the Dark Elves of the Aurelian Spires. Nathan had personally seen to that. Clerks and servants wandered the halls of the palace. Nathan recognized some, but far from all of them. A senior servant told Nathan that Anna was lurking in her study, so that was where he and Faye went. "Everybody here is wearing your crest," Faye said, poking Nathan in the side. He frowned at that. While Anna had been encouraging the emblem among the beastkin, she had stopped short of doing so among her personal guards.
She was new here, and TARDIS had been on the verge of riots before Nathan swept in.
More than Beastkin are wearing them here, Nathan said, as they stopped in front of Anna's study.
Of course they are,
a new voice chirped next to them.
You and Anna are together. We can show our support for the Liberator and support our Duchess at the same time, Lord Nathan.
He suppressed a grimace and turned to face the newcomer. An attractive woman, only a few years older than Fay, beamed at him. She had long blonde hair and pricked horse ears, a long silken horsetail, and wore the same uniform that Fay did. Two garnets gleamed from her collarbone.
Fire, was it? Nathan asked, remembering the champion's name. We met in passing when you first arrived here with Duke Tereus.
Fire's eyes lit up, and her ears shot bolt upright.
Yes, my lord, but I don't have anything to do with any of the other dukes anymore. Although I may be a champion in service to one of Duke Tereus's bastions, I serve you and Duchess Anna in every conceivable way.
Fay scowled at Fire. Before the cat girl did anything foolish, Nathan gave her a push. Rolling her eyes, Fay went ahead. Fire followed Fay with her eyes for a few seconds, before turning back to Nathan with a more subdued gaze.
Is there anything wrong with showing you our support, Liberator?
Drumming his fingers on his leg, Nathan wondered how open he should be with this champion. He knew little about her. One of his other champions, Narime, had recommended her. Fire had become a duo gem champion in the Federation while slavery was still practiced, which spoke well of her abilities. Surely she knew of the dangerous political situation?
It's not your support that's the problem, Fire, Nathan said, half lying.
Truthfully, he found her idolization of him deeply uncomfortable.
But what do you think everybody else sees? The Empire just arrived. The merchants and villagers will see division when we need to be presenting a united front.
A frown initially formed on Fire's face as he spoke. Slowly, it vanished, and she smiled brightly at him. She snapped off a salute.
I get it, my lord, she chirped, her eyes practically glowing. I'll talk to the others about being less obvious.
He wasn't sure she did get it, but he'd take what he could get. Fire was a Beastkin champion from the Federation, so she was bound to be influential here. After returning the salute, Nathan stepped into Anna's study. Fire watched his every move.
Getting to know your latest champion?
Anna greeted him when he entered, her voice dry. Nathan closed the door and pretended that he hadn't heard Fire whine in response to his action. The study was warded against eavesdropping, and the horse girl had clearly intended to do exactly that. Despite the name, Anna's study was closer to a lounge. A few black sofas with plush upholstery dominated the room. A large desk in the corner allowed the room to technically be called a study. The architecture itself was dated, with tiny claustrophobic windows, vaulted ceilings, and huge cornices. But the furnishings and paint gave the room a sleek feeling. Nathan froze when he saw a large black door at the far end. It looked incredibly out of place, and nobody else paid any attention to it, probably because they couldn't see it. The black door was a doorway to another world that only Nathan could see. It belonged to the messenger he had made his dark deal with. He chose to ignore it. A petite woman with dirty blonde hair done up in curls lounged on one sofa. Anna had been letting her hair grow out since she met Nathan. Her hair had once been shoulder length and was stretching farther and farther down her back every time he found time to be with her. She wore a ruffled black dress that had slits in all the right places, and the way she moved her legs gave Nathan tantalizing glimpses of what he had to look forward to tonight.
Hungry, are we? Did you hold back while you were staying with Vera?
Anna asked with a smile. She rose from her seat and approached Nathan.
He swept her in his arms and drew her into a kiss. His hands quickly wandered and investigated what he'd spied earlier. Anna moaned into his mouth. She rubbed his back, surrendering to him. A stare bore into Nathan. The cat girl responsible didn't make a noise, but she made her presence known. Nathan pulled away from Anna, who gasped for air when he released her.
"Wow, I don't see you for a couple of weeks, and you try to kill me with a kiss," Anna said, with wide eyes. "Please don't tell me that's what tonight's going to be like. I've heard from the others that you can sometimes be a little more impressive down there."
"Oh, you haven't seen it," Faye crooned, her voice oozing with superiority.
The smirk on her face spoke volumes.
"Nathan's best at his biggest."
"Faye, enough," Nathan said, rolling his eyes. "Be a good kitty." She clicked her tongue.
"Fine."
Her smirk didn't vanish.
"But I wasn't lying. He's totally better like that."
"I'd believe you, but you also told me that he tasted great. Your opinions in the bedroom are a little lopsided, Faye," Anna said.
Nathan and Anna dropped onto the sofas. As Faye had been cattier lately, Nathan avoided sitting next to either woman. He sat opposite Faye instead. Not that it mattered. Faye jumped over the coffee table and sat next to him. Her tail curled around his back, and she purred. Anna rolled her eyes.
"So, what do you think of Fire?"
"I've met her twice. It's hard to have an opinion of her," Nathan said.
"Really? Because you seemed to form an opinion of Faye and the others pretty quickly."
Anna narrowed her eyes at him. "Damn. Good catch." Nathan had known Faye and most of his champions from his original world. But to everybody else, his ability to judge people's characters was uncannily good. "I had reports on Faye from her Meisters in the Academy. Plus, she's a young girl from the Beastkin Enclave near Garrick. Fire has fought for the Federation her entire life. She has baggage here." Nathan frowned. "I trusted her because Narime did. Have you gotten along with her?"
"Better than I expected," Anna said. "I didn't know if I'd be able to trust a champion that isn't yours, but she's so starry-eyed about you, it's adorable."
"Adorable," Nathan said flatly. Faye pouted.
"Yes, adorable," Anna repeated. "There's something different about her compared to the other Beastkin. Fire seems almost pure when she talks about you."
She shrugged in response to his look.
"I can't put it in words, but it makes her easy to trust. She's been reliable and a huge help as I try to settle in."
Nathan winced. "I take it that's been rough?"
"Rough doesn't begin to cover it," Anna huffed. "The desk in my office is piled this high with paperwork."
She raised a hand as high as she could for effect.
"My calendar fills with meetings if I don't fill it first. The only reason I eat with other people is because Fire joins me for meals. Because otherwise, I'm eating while working."
"What's this, then?" Nathan asked, gesturing to the study that was noticeably empty of any work. Anna coughed. Her cheeks reddened, and she looked away. She mumbled something under her breath. Given Faye's ears pricked up and the cat girl smiled, Nathan assumed it was something cute. "I'm afraid I didn't catch that," he asked innocently.
"Are you going to make me say it?" Anna grumbled.
"Yes."
"Bastard."
He waited patiently while Faye giggled next to him.
"I cleared my calendar when I found out you were coming," Anna said, face red as a cherry. "Fire helped a lot. Shooed away courtiers, rearranged meetings, and ensured my clerks were dealing with any important paperwork today and tomorrow. I should be able to spend some time with you, given I haven't seen you for weeks, right?"
Well, that certainly explained some of Anna's appreciation of Fire. Nathan felt some in turn. "We should probably discuss the situation despite that," Nathan said.
but I'm glad we have some time to ourselves for fun.
Fay prodded him in the side. Can I get him to myself for a night first? Anna suggested, her eyes narrowing at Faye's unsubtle attempt to inject herself into the situation.
For a night, Faye declared, taking a mile when offered an inch.
Have you finished the move? Nathan asked.
I don't think I'll ever finish the move, Anna said. I'm beginning to realize how silly this whole duchy is. I spent my life being raised to take care of a little county, and everything I learned related to it and the Diet. Voting procedures, committees, laws, and fairly minor procedural matters. Now I'm one of the most powerful and wealthiest nobles, other than the Archdukes.
Both Nathan and Anna sighed. Before he had invaded the Federation, Anna had been the countess he worked with as Bastion. She governed a moderately sized parcel of land called Garrick County. It had been a border county that ran along the Garrick Mountains, which separated the Federation and Empire. When the Federation surrendered to the Empire and the regents were converted into dukes, the question had been what to do with High Lord Tanius's former province. Most of it had been given to Anna, who had been promoted to Duchess.
Regretting your decision to become a duchess rather than stay countess? Nathan asked.
Never, Anna snapped, glaring at Nathan. She bit her lip. You were right to call me out when I initially refused to become duchess. It's not like things would be better if I remained a countess. Milgar gave me all this land anyway. The only difference is that, she trailed off, neither of them needed to say more. Anna had almost chosen to step out of Nathan's life a month ago. Nathan had confronted her over it and discovered her true feelings. The result had been that she had negotiated with the Emperor and Milgar to become a duchess instead of remaining as countess. It was also the reason she was going to be curled up against him tonight.
Has Archduke von Milgar given you a hand in anything? Nathan asked, changing the topic. If you're so overwhelmed, surely he'd help a noble allied with him and the Emperor.
He's handling a lot of the political bullshit. There are 11 new dukes, plus me. The Diet has been in a constant state of chaos since the Emperor announced all the new nobles in the Federation, and, oh right, there's a war on, Anna scowled. I think I get a dozen threatening letters a day from nationalist-aligned nobles about why I'm not sending you and all of my knights up to Trefome.
Fucking hell, Nathan muttered.
The nationalists were a powerful faction of nobles in the Empire that believed in imperial supremacy over the rest of the world. Nathan's father was a powerful member of the faction. They had been implicated in a lot of problems last year, and were the cause of a war with the Empire's northern neighbor, Trefome. The letters get screened, so you don't need to worry about any of them killing me. Fire did bodyguard duty for Tarius, and was in charge of protecting a portal, so she's experienced. Anna smiled. I miss Kuda's coffee, but there's something nice about a knight who openly lusts for the man you're sleeping with. Something told Nathan that most women wouldn't share Anna's opinion. Then again, most women weren't in a relationship like Anna's. Fay was far from the only woman that she had to share Nathan with, after all.
Speaking of coffee, why don't we have something to drink? Nathan suggested.
Anna and Fay nodded in response. For some reason, he half expected Fire to burst through the door with a tray of drinks, but nothing happened. She either hadn't penetrated the room's wards, or was smart enough not to give herself away. He rose and found a table with refreshments. While he used the magic-powered percolator to prepare coffee for himself and Anna, he poured a glass of milk for Fay. While she'd drink coffee and tea, her preferences were for cold drinks. Given her alcohol tolerance, he added a glug of cream liqueur to the milk. "Is the land the problem?" Fay asked, while his back was turned. "How rare." Fay rarely spoke up during discussions like these. Usually, she dutifully listened and asked Nathan questions later.
Not the land itself, but the variety, Anna said. I rule 3 distinct regions now. Garrick County, Tardis, and the Beastkin Enclave that you grew up in. The Enclave takes care of itself, but I'm split between Garrick and Tardis.
Isn't that normally why you have other nobles? Faye asked.
Nathan chuckled.
Yes, that's exactly why.
That's easier said than done. My family ran Garrick for years. It's a tiny place in the boonies. Finding somebody to run the county is difficult, at least until my brother returns from the war against Trafalm, Anna said. Whereas Tardis is just chaotic. The removal of slavery has thrown the economy into chaos.
I thought you said that lots of Beastkin were coming here from the rest of the Federation,
Nathan said, remembering another conversation. They are, but they want to be paid, Nathan. Or to work for you. Or me, Anna laughed. I think I understand why Tanius wanted to invade my county. I've been looking at farmland for the Beastkin, only to find out that half of the land on this side of the mountains isn't arable. You can't grow a damn thing without huge irrigation projects. But Garrick is mostly wilderness, an untapped place that the rest of the Empire looked down on. Nathan blinked. He carried the tray of drinks to the sofas, careful not to spill any. Grinning at him, Faye snatched up her liquored-up drink. Nathan and Anna enjoyed their coffees at a more sedate pace.
That figures. So there are lots of Beastkin, but the local manufacturers and merchants don't want to pay them,
Nathan summarized. Can't pay them, they claim, Anna corrected. Practically the entire manufacturing and transport industry of Tardis ran on slave labor. Food seems to be unaffected, because the Beastkin were kept in the cities.
The land belongs to the people. Being able to raise a family in a village is the right of citizens, Nathan said automatically, remembering lessons drilled into him from childhood. That's a problem.
Why?
Because you're talking about giving the Beastkin farmland. How many of them even know how to farm?
Anna stared at him.
Eh? Even I can till a field, Nathan, Faye said with a silly smile.
Do you know how to farm, Anna? Nathan asked.
The noblewoman continued to stare at him.
Shit.
You're dealing with a huge population of urban slaves, Anna. The first time most of them left the cities they were born in was when the Empire freed them. I doubt many of them have even seen a field in their lives.
Well, that's a new headache to deal with, Anna said. She drained her coffee, then immediately rose and poured a new one from the batch prepared by Nathan.
I hate to say this now, but given these problems, is it really smart to encourage the Beastkin to wear those damn patches? Nathan probed, feeling that he had enough leverage to bring up the topic.
Oh, goddess, of course you raise this, Anna said. He imagined that she rolled her eyes as her back was turned to him. Those are the one thing I'm not worried about. Half the damn Empire hates us, Nathan. Hates me. The Beastkin call you Liberator.
I hadn't noticed, he drawled.
Don't be a dick, she snapped. Your father has a reputation as a violent warmonger who hates non-humans. Beastkin treat you as the literal opposite to him. Like it or not, the Empire is squaring off. We're in the Emperor's corner, along with Milgar. We should be making it clear that we have support among the people.
Some people, Nathan said. Look, Anna, how many people give a shit about the arguments in the Diet? Emperor Gortal isn't about to drop dead. All this does is scare some farmers and merchants.
The Nationalists aren't going to wait for the Emperor to die of natural causes, Nathan, Anna said. There's no rightful heir to the Erengar dynasty. All the Emperor's children, except Alice, will be opposed by the Diet for one reason or another. And Alice is Milgar's granddaughter, so the Constitution forbids her from taking the throne. If we don't prepare for civil war,
Anna, Nathan said gently, and she stopped. She grimaced and looked away.
After several long moments, she looked back at him. I do think you're right that the patches are antagonistic, but so is everything your stupid father is doing. We need to prepare, Nathan. You are going to help me, right? I know you have some personal hang-ups over this, but please.
Part of him wanted to say no. The internal problems of the Empire frustrated him. The entire system seemed inherently broken and ready to collapse at a moment's notice. When he first arrived here, he had thought that he would stop the war, then immediately head to his homeland of Falmir and worry about its problems. But for some reason, he felt differently about the Empire now. He cared for Anna, who considered the Empire her home. Earlier this year, he had met Princess Alice Arengar, the Emperor's granddaughter, and become attached to her. And, of course, Nathan cared about all of his champions and the people he protected.
Yes, I will help you. We'll need to spend the next couple of years building support within your duchy and preparing my champions and military for the worst. But that means not pissing people off early, simply because the Nationalists are swinging their dicks at us, Nathan said.
Faye giggled at the image. I guess you're right, Anna said. A couple of years, huh? That seems like a lot of time to prepare, but compared to how long the Nationalists have been trying to oust Emperor Gortal,
it's enough time to train Vera, get new gems for Faye and the others, and deal with any political issues, Nathan said. Our position is unstable right now.
Right, Vera, Anna nodded, then narrowed her eyes. So, when are you going to break it to Fire that you plan to assign her to Vera instead of taking her on as your own champion?
Nathan winced. I have no idea. She's so smitten with me.
Honestly, just bed her and let Vera find a new champion. There are plenty of beastkin you can find, including in the castle, Anna said. Where are you going to find a cute, loyal horse girl like her?
Nathan stared at the wall and didn't reply.
He did, after all, already know of one such horse girl. While he'd been avoiding thinking of her too much, she was still firmly rooted in his mind. Kiana, the young unicorn beastkin training under Leopold, and who was currently in the Empire's capital of Alaik. Compared to Fire, Nathan found Kiana far more attractive. He had spent many years with Kiana. A dark memory came to Nathan's mind. He banished the thoughts and remembered why he hadn't been thinking of Kiana since the war with the Federation started.
That look tells me it's time to change the subject, Anna said. Why don't we talk about what's been happening in the capital lately? I bet you're interested in what Alice has been up to. She tells me things that she doesn't tell you.
Chapter 3. Alice. A young woman strode through the upper levels of the Grand Hall of Alaik's Imperial Palace. Her name was Alice Arengar, and she was the granddaughter of both Emperor Gortal and Archduke von Milgar. Within her arms was a small bundle of paperwork. She wore a stunning red and gold dress emblazoned with the emblems of both the royal family and the Empire. The only nod to her relation to the Archduke was a tiny emblem woven into her collar. Her long, thick golden hair billowed behind her as she made her way to the far end of the hall. The only other people present in the hall were royal guards, plus Alice's bodyguard, who shadowed her by a few dozen feet. This hall was the official throne room of the Empire. A gargantuan throne built from steel, glass, and granite sat at one end. The wings of the hall allowed it to hold thousands of people at once, particularly given there were three separate levels. When the Imperial Diet was in session, nobles could be separated according to status. Quite literally, the archdukes and other powerful nobles could look down upon the lesser nobles. Petitioners faced the imposing gaze of people they couldn't look in the eye. Supposedly, the emperor sat at the bottom, as a sign of his humble service to the Diet and the nobility of the empire.
The emperor was, after all, an elected position within the Anfeng Empire. But the Diet wasn't in session. The spring session had ended. Half of the nobles had been up north fighting Trafoam anyway and couldn't attend. Alice walked through an empty hall, surrounded by the ghosts of arguments she remembered from the past few weeks. Once she left the grand hall, she slipped into a smaller chamber immediately behind it. Massive knights stood guard at every entrance to this chamber. Their armor and weapons glowed with imposing runes, and Alice knew that every one of them was a trained spellblade. These were the royal knights, the emperor's personal bodyguards.
"Good day, Princess Alice," they greeted her, their breastplates thundering as they saluted her. Their helmets and magical voice modulation prevented her from identifying any of them. They were measures to protect the families of the royal knights, so they might live normal lives outside their duties to the emperor. Alice disliked the fact she could never grow to know any of the knights who protected her grandfather, and herself, indirectly, but she understood why. She smiled back at the knights and curtsied. Then she entered the chamber.
"I don't see any reason for me to waste my time in the spires, Leo,"
the deep baritone of her grandfather rumbled.
"It's unprecedented for the Aurelian Council to invite a foreign ruler to help oversee a criminal trial, Gortal,"
Leopold said, his voice far gentler than it ever was when he spoke to Alice.
"The Dark Elves are genuinely surprised by what happened to the portal, if we believe Ambassador Sarive's words. We need to take their request seriously."
"I know that," the Emperor snapped.
A loud sigh.
"But I cannot go. I wouldn't have an empire to return to."
Alice froze, eyes wide. She had stumbled onto an incredibly serious discussion. Given her position, nothing stopped her from entering this chamber, but she was certain that neither her grandfather nor Leopold wanted her to hear this discussion. She coughed, then stepped into the chamber proper.
"Grandpa, I've completed the paperwork relating to trade law changes for our new duchies, plus some other things."
Everybody in the room stared at her, which was quite a few people. Although the grand hall was the official throne room, this chamber was the true throne room. A much smaller but far more expensive throne sat at one end. It was made of gold and all manner of strange metals that caught the light in fascinating ways. Right now, it was empty. Supposedly, this throne room was where the Watcher Omria had crowned emperors in the days when she still walked Domar.
"Ah, Alice, I didn't hear you enter," the emperor said with a smile. "Leopold, if you would."
A handful of knights stood in the wings of the room. They turned away from Alice first, once they recognized her. Emperor Gortal stood in the center of the room, wearing a huge furred cape over his entire body that hid his advancing age. An elegantly dressed cat beastkin stood next to him, one of the emperor's mistresses, no doubt. Or perhaps she was just a lover. Alice didn't know if a man could have a mistress if he was a widower. The other four people in the room were far more familiar to Alice. Leopold smiled at her. His silvered hair and sideburns belied his age, but he still cut an imposing figure in his bastion uniform. He stepped forward and took the paperwork from Alice.
"I think we can assume you heard our discussion," Leopold said dryly, his eyes twinkling.
Alice looked away with a grimace. The emperor chuckled.
"It's no trouble, Alice. Join us. The knights wouldn't have let you in if you weren't supposed to be here."
Despite his words, he gave a uniformed woman standing by the throne a subtle signal. Something told Alice that she wasn't supposed to have been let in. That uniformed woman was named Malus, and she was a bastion like Leopold and Nathan. She was responsible for the defense of the imperial capital, Alaic. Her darker skin indicated that she wasn't native to the region, and she towered over almost everybody else in the room. Her uniform hugged her lean, muscled figure. Malus was one of the most powerful bastions in the empire. She commanded a trigem champion
and was responsible for defending one of the oldest active portals on Domar. Her relative youth only made her achievements more apparent. Much like Nathan, Alice mused. She wondered what Melis would make of him. Melis was a taciturn bastion who rarely spoke other than to give orders, but she appeared to be of a similar age to Nathan. The other two people present were champions, both duo gems. One was May, Leopold's closest and most trusted champion and lover. The other was one of Melis's champions, a stern-looking man with a square jaw and a mage's staff. "Are things really that bad?" Alice blurted out, eyes wide. The Emperor sighed. He leaned on a long ebony cane, which was capped with rune-encrusted black steel. Slowly, he ambled over to the throne. His beastkin mistress walked with him, her hands hovering by his side. Eventually, he settled into his throne and faced Alice.
"Perhaps, perhaps not. But a wise ruler does not stoke a fire needlessly," he said. "The Diet has yet to find a rhythm, now that there are so many new nobles from our new territories. Many nobles need time to realize that their fears of losing their titles, power, and money to a horde of foreigners taking over the Empire is simple fear-mongering by opportunists. Which is a long way of saying, yes, it is that bad," Leopold said flatly.
The Emperor glared at him, while Melis nodded.
"Do you need me to help, Grandpa?" Alice asked.
He smiled at her.
"I will always welcome your help, my dear Alice. It's been a delight to see you almost every day, and especially in your mother's dresses. They suit you so well."
They hadn't been why Alice was wearing them, although she had been pillaging her mother's closets. Alice didn't own many dresses, and especially not many that screamed, "I'm an imperial princess." But the sheer pride and joy in her grandfather's eyes stopped her from saying anything. She smiled back. Privately, she wondered why there was a hint of sadness in the Emperor's eyes.
"The simplest way is for Her Imperial Highness to visit the spires in your place. But..."
Leopold trailed off.
"No,"
the Emperor thundered.
"You and I both know the sort of mockery they will subject any visitor to. Even if the Aurelian Council is genuine about our involvement, the Dark Elves won't change overnight. They despise us."
"Didn't they help us take the Federation?" Alice mentioned, although she privately agreed.
She had heard stories about the Dark Elves, and her interactions with the Dark Elf Ambassador had been less than pleasant. Silence fell.
"Truthfully, I don't know what to make of that," Leopold said. "They wanted Taunius," the Emperor said. "And they've been genuine about helping us reinforce the fortresses along the Haukim Desert. I think you're right that the Cascade scared them." "Maybe, but from what I heard about Astra's behavior, I think there's something else," Leopold said.
"You mean the part where she insulted literally everybody except Nathan? Or something else?" Alice said dryly.
She winced when everybody looked at her with a raised eyebrow.
"Yes, that part," Leopold drawled. "Astra is a legend. Children's books have been written about her. The fact she backed Nathan is to our benefit," the Emperor said. "But I get your point."
He smiled.
"Perhaps we should reach out to Bastion Nathan once he's free. He has history with Taunius, and the Dark Elves respect him. Sir Eves certainly does. Surely they won't refuse us if we send him to the spires to help with the trial."
Alice blinked at the sudden shift. Leopold agreed, and there were a few brief comments to close off the topic, while Alice's mind whirred. Hadn't that been a little sudden?
and obvious?
I'll see to this paperwork, the Emperor said, waving a hand at the bundle that Alice brought. I also need to look at the recent ceasefire proposal from Trofome. Alice, could you look at the outstanding proposals from the Diet relating to the Imperial Army?
Of course, Grandpa, she said, hiding her frown. He tried to stand up, then grunted.
Gordy, his mistress gasped, grabbing his arm as she helped him to his feet.
Gordy? Alice refused to stare. Her grandmother had passed away when she was young. Since then, the Emperor had enjoyed the affections of a number of women that he kept as close servants. The situation was a natural one for Alice. Nobles tended to keep mistresses, although her grandfather had supposedly maintained his fidelity to his wife until her passing. Both Leopold and Nathan had several women sharing their beds, but the Emperor was her grandfather. She found it difficult to consider that women the same age as her mother slept with him. Sometimes the same age as her. Even if he was the most powerful man in the Empire and potentially the world. With careful steps, the Emperor walked out of the throne room. He leaned heavily on his cane, and his mistress clung to his side, her face a picture of worry. Behind him, Melis and the other knights followed.
Has he always been so old? Alice mumbled.
I believe I told you something similar when you came to Garrick Pass, Leopold said from beside her.
She jumped and then glared at him. I thought you'd left with Grandpa.
Melis and the knights can protect him. Leopold gestured to a different exit. Shall we go somewhere?
They left the chamber, Alice following Leopold. Surprisingly, he led her to the Grand Hall. After a few gestures, the guards moved farther away. May and Alice's bodyguard kept their distance. This doesn't seem very private, Alice said. She looked around, but saw nobody other than guards.
Nowhere is private in the palace, not even the throne room, Leopold said. But Melis has a binding stone on the outskirts of the city and absolute control over the palace. Her wards are impenetrable as a result. I can't do the same. This, he gestured to the empty space around them, this works better than you'd think. It's hard for someone to hide in a large space, especially if you use magic to suppress our voices.
Alice got his point and cast a simple spell. While Leopold was a bastion, he wasn't a sorcerer. She was.
Good, he said,
then smiled at her.
You're doing well. I haven't seen you since...
Since you nearly died, Alice finished darkly. I'm told you're fighting fit, but are you really? I saw you, Uncle. You were... She stopped, unable to finish the sentence. You looked bad. I can't believe Nathan came out of that battle nearly unharmed. Leopold frowned at her last statement.
For all intents and purposes, I am good to fight. I am a bastion. My duty involves courting death in order to protect the Empire.
That doesn't reassure me, Uncle.
I'm being honest with you, Alice, he said.
He looked her in the eyes, then sighed.
I wished that this day would never come, that things would work out. You could putter about under Hans and eventually become Archduchess in your own time.
Hans was her other grandfather, Archduke Hans von Milgar, one of the Emperor's staunchest allies and closest friends. This is about Nathan, isn't it? She asked.
Yes, but also no. It's more about the things that have happened. And Nathan is in the middle of them.
Leopold stared up at the vaulted ceiling of the hall. Huge stained glass domes dotted it.
Astra isn't the only person who noticed what happened when the messenger attacked Garrick Pass. Only the most important. I nearly died, and an inexperienced bastion came out unharmed.
Then Nathan invaded the Federation, defeated another bastion, and captured Tanius, Alice said.
It's the stuff of legends,
Leopold said. One doesn't need to be terribly bright to notice it. He's known far beyond our borders.
So, that explained the sudden willingness to send him to the spires. Nathan was her grandfather's newest weapon in his political battle with the Nationalists. A booming sound echoed throughout the hall. The armor and weapons of guards rattled as they looked to the source. The gargantuan double doors that led into the grand hall ground open, their mechanisms clacking as they swiftly reacted to a force pushing them open. Two figures entered the hall. One was a dark elf champion who showed off enough skin that Alice wondered if she instead put clothes on when she had sex. Two amethysts glittered from her collar, above her voluptuous dark curves. The elf's purple eyes focused on Alice immediately, and she fluttered her fingertips in a wave. Alice waved back gently, then focused on the other figure. This one was far less welcoming to her. A gigantic bear of a man thundered across the hall. He wore a multitude of furs over his bastion uniform and heavy armor. Despite being a bastion, and therefore in the sole service to the Emperor, he wore his family crest, a stylized helmet on a white shield and black background. His shaggy mane of black hair framed a gaunt face with steely eyes. If one looked closer at those furs, they would quickly realize they were tails. Alice knew they were taken from Beastkin. This man was Tarbin von Straub, the Crimson Warhound, Nathan's father, technically. Nathan had been disowned by Tarbin a couple of years ago. The woman with him was Nerevia, one of Tarbin's duo-gem champions.
Tyrim, you're here, Tarbin called out, calling Leopold by his last name. Where's Gortal?
Leopold's expression darkened.
His Majesty is busy with important affairs.
I can guess which affairs. That's why I need to see him, you old bastard.
Tarbin stopped short of Leopold and glared at him. Both men were giants. They stood well over 6 feet tall, and Malus was one of the few people in the Empire who ever towered over them. Tarbin had the slight edge over Leopold here, but only because he was in full armor. Alice found it amusing that Tarbin was doing the male equivalent of wearing high heels so that he could appear taller.
Like it or not, Tarbin, the ceasefire is being agreed to, Leopold said, a hint of a smirk floating on his face. All that remains are the terms. I assume that's why you're here, instead of doing your job up north.
I'm doing my job by coming down here and convincing Gortal to send us some of the champions lazing around in his pet duchy,
Tarbin snapped. A snarl formed on his face.
Why don't you ask your son yourself for some help? Leopold suggested.
Tarbin's hands balled up into fists. Alice felt magic well up around the man. Instantly, Leopold reacted. Nerevia's amethysts flashed. Her hands darted for one of the dozen weapons sheathed on her scant clothing. Both champions behind Alice reached for their weapons. The nearby guards panicked, yells erupting from them. Then a thrum of power ran throughout the entire hall. Alice felt her knees buckle. Every guard collapsed to the ground. The bastions and champions halted. They appeared untouched by whatever happened.
I don't think you should test Malus, Leopold said, fury filling his face. You can play your games, Leopold, but the glory of the Watcher Omria will not be denied.
Tarbin slammed a fist against his breastplate. Then the man spun and stormed out of the palace. Nerevia left with him. Alice's hand pressed against her chest, her fingers running along the golden lace trim. Her breathing slowed as she steadied herself. The chill of the black and white stone flooring seeped into her body as she kneeled.
Princess Alice,
A hushed voice came from behind her as her bodyguard rushed to her side. He quickly checked her for any injuries, then shook his head at Leopold. A moment later, the bodyguard retreated. Leopold helped Alice to her feet. He grimaced at her.
"I am sorry about that. You are all right?"
"No," Alice thought. She wanted someone else to be the one to check on her and to protect her. While she still spoke with Nathan from time to time, his voice was a far cry from his physical presence. "It's fine, Uncle. I understand that this is what things have come to. I've made my decision to stand with Grandpa. Both of them." Her eyes flashed. The smile on Leopold's face was a sad one. Somehow, it made Leopold look his age. Alice worried about how old so many of the powerful figures in her life seemed to be. Leopold joked about his age, but for the first time, he looked it. His face looked weathered, and he moved very deliberately. "You and Tarbin have an old rivalry, don't you?" she asked.
"I'd say that it's closer to a political rivalry," Leopold said with a chuckle. "The rest is simple jealousy. We're close in age, only a decade between us. But I'm an influential bastion despite losing my noble lineage, and he's gone nowhere."
Alice stared at him. That was surprisingly forthright for Leopold. Then something hit Alice. "A decade? How can that be? You're not even 60, and Nathan is over 30. Leopold snorted.
"Not everybody waits until they're good and old to have children, Alice. The reason why Tarbin is still a count despite being a bastion is because he stumbled on a technicality. He knocked up a countess while in the academy, and they insisted that he take responsibility. Money talks, as do votes in the Diet, and Tarbin became one of the few bastions to retain his title. Not that he's supposed to use the damn thing."
Bastions were soldiers. Alice knew that Nathan had run his father's county before he had been disowned, precisely because Tarbin wasn't supposed to be involved with political affairs.
"Is it really the right thing to prevent bastions to be involved in politics?" Alice asked aloud. Leopold gave her an odd look, but he remained silent. "You're deeply involved in it," Alice said, "as is Nathan. While Anna, Grandpa, and I have owned the political decisions of the war with the Federation, the reality is different. You and Nathan made all the moves. Pretending that he isn't a noble because he doesn't have Vaughn in his name is cute, but it seems pointless."
A slow nod.
"Perhaps," Leopold said. "Many things are changing. Things that should have changed long ago, when the Empire first started facing problems."
Suspecting that Leopold was about to go on a long tangent, Alice changed the subject. She had no interest in talking about ancient history, at least not with Leopold. He'd lectured her dozens of times about the topic.
"I still can't believe Nathan and that brute are related," Alice remarked.
"Really? Because, despite the physical differences, it's more apparent than ever now," Leopold smirked.
"How? Tarbin's an asshole and a monster. He started wearing beastkin tails around, simply because of Nathan."
Alice glowered at the exit from the palace.
"Maybe, but I've known Tarbin for a long time. And think about it. The Empire is now split into two separate factions."
Leopold held up one hand.
"We have Tarbin, a boisterous monster who hates non-humans and wishes to conquer all the Empire's enemies for imperial glory."
Then he raised the other hand.
"Opposite him is Nathan, his son, and a quiet but beloved strategist who adores non-humans and..." "Finish the sentence for me."
Alice stared at Leopold. She tried to keep the shock off her face.
"Are you suggesting that Nathan is the same as Tarbin? People said this about Tanius, and I never really bought it," she said.
"What makes some people similar aren't how they act,
But their drives, Leopold said.
If nothing else, the parallel makes for a great story. Father and son, powerful bastions, both believers in imperial glory, staunch supporters of the goddess. But they hold violently opposing views on non-humans. It becomes very hard to argue one is morally superior to the other.
The smile on Leopold's face was one that Alice was much less familiar with. It wasn't the smile of her genial uncle, but that of the Emperor's right-hand man. A web had been woven. Alice wondered how long ago the spider had started weaving it. And, for that matter, who was caught up in this web? Chapter 4. The days passed quickly at Anna's palace. Nathan had escaped his duties by visiting Vera, but only briefly. The bureaucracy swiftly caught up to him. Like Anna, he had also vastly increased his power. He now controlled 4 separate binding stones and their respective fortresses. His home base of Garrick Pass, Seraph's Haunt of Fort Tobram, just east of the Garrick Mountains, the very phallic marble fortress of Castle Forselberg,